We continue today in our series on the grace of God. We've called God's grace the transforming influence of God's character. And we've seen this summer how it transforms how we think and view different areas of our lives. We've talked about how it transforms how we view God's blessings, His provisions for us, how it transforms how we view ourselves, how we view our weaknesses. 2 weeks ago, we talked about how we view the decisions that we make in the light of God's grace. Last week, we talked about our view of money in light of God's grace. And today, we discuss how does God's grace influence how I relate with other believers? As a Christian, how do I relate to other Christians? And you can see it right at the top of your notes. The grace of God transforms how I relate with fellow believers to be how Christ relates with fellow believers. That's no surprise that as we seek to be like Christ, we hope that we are transformed to act like Him, to reflect Him in a greater way. And to do this, to relate well with believers, it's worthy of our time to think about how God relates to me and how He sees me. And so you see this in your notes there too. Our second sermon in the series of grace this summer, we talked about how does God's grace transform the way that I know God sees me. And this is what we said, that God sees us as saints and not sinners, with a new heart, not old hearts, as new creatures, not our old identity, as forgiven, not condemned, as His children, not strangers. If you haven't heard that message, you can check it out on the podcast and listen to that one to get more in depth there. But if we believe what God says about the way He views us as being in Christ, it gives us a radically transformed perspective about who we are and about who our fellow believers are. And we have to start there. Because if I understand how God sees me, I'm now equipped to see you in the same light. God sees me this way. God sees you that way. Now I can see you as God sees you. And when we get there, we're primed to learn then how do we relate to other believers. And we're going to see that this morning from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. I invite you to turn there. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Just going to look at one verse, verse 14. I think that's a good reminder for those of us that are seeking to follow Jesus, that we're not there yet. We haven't arrived. And what might take us just a few minutes to understand one verse here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 might take us our entire lives to live out, our entire lives to apply this and live this out as we seek to follow Jesus. In 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12, Paul has begun a series of short exhortations to the church there. And in 12 through 13, he's described to the Thessalonians how they are to view their leaders. And now in verse 14, he begins to describe how the church, the community, is to relate to each other. And he begins this way, "Now I exhort you, brethren," the first part there, verse 14. Paul instructs the Thessalonians here about how they relate with each other. What should their conduct be within the church? And he gives them here an exhortation. Now, we don't use the word exhort much in our everyday language, but I think of exhorting as giving a charge that you would be different. To encourage is similar, but we use encourage oftentimes of that's a nice dress, or that's a nice car, or great job, and those are good things. It's worthy of being encouraging in that way. But exhorting seems to go to a deeper place, that I'm speaking into a deeper part of you, into your heart, such that I would push you to be different, to be more like Jesus. And when we think about the spiritual gift of exhortation, that's what we're looking at, someone that speaks into you, that sees that in you and calls that out, a charge to be different. And he gives this charge here to the brethren, the believers, the people, the redeemed of the church in Thessalonica. And he's going to talk about four different types of struggles and four different ways of relating with these believers. And it's important for us, before we look at them, to understand a couple of things. That each different struggle that Paul gives is going to require a different way of relating. The Christian life and ministering as fellow believers is not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a cookie-cutter approach. We can't take it that way. You're an individual with your own story and your own struggles, and so the way we relate with that is an individual way there. And so it's going to be important for us to define the words and define the exhortations that Paul gives. The second thing to note, though, is that any one person can struggle with any one of these things at any time. And thus, Paul isn't putting you in a box saying, this is what defines you or this is who you are. But he's saying, you might be struggling with this right now, and tomorrow it might be a different issue. And the day after that, it might be something different. In fact, in one day, you might go through a range of struggles, and each one of those struggles requires a different way of relating. It's not the same. And thus, the way we show grace to fellow believers changes from day to day, struggle to struggle. But the first one, Paul says, warn those who are unruly. Warn those who are unruly. What does it mean to be unruly? It means to be out of step, out of sync, disorderly. But you ask, out of step from what? On Paul's second missionary journey is when he encounters and ministers to the Thessalonians. And he spends at least 3 weeks there. In Acts 17, he shows up and spends three Sabbaths teaching and ministering to the Jews there. As was his custom, though, he first spent time in the synagogue and then likely spent time with the Gentiles or the Greeks. And so he spent somewhere from 3 weeks to maybe a few months there, depending on what timeline you look at. And as part of his instruction there to that early church that he had a part in forming, he would have spoken to them about the return of Jesus. And the idea that, as the angel said there in the book of Acts, just as you saw Jesus go up, he's going to come again one day. And so this early new church had a view about the return of Christ. However, it seems as if they expected Jesus to come back soon, very soon, in fact. And because they viewed the return of Jesus as happening very soon, well, they seem to have quit working, stopped, become idle. Some of your translations will say that, idle. Now, we believe the return of Jesus is imminent, but imminent doesn't mean soon. It means it can happen at any moment. But the Thessalonians thought it's coming back very quickly, and so they stopped working. And because they became idle, they started to cause problems. They started to become dependent on others. Without work comes no money. And with no money becomes no food. And no food means that's a bad thing. So I need you to help me. In fact, the problem seems to have become so big in the church there that even in the book of 2 Thessalonians, Paul is still addressing this issue with the unruly. And in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, he spends a big chunk of this talking about these individuals. And he calls these unruly there in 2 Thessalonians 3, he calls them busybodies. You know the type. Not a lot going on, but everything going on. Causing problems, getting into problems. I remember as a kid in elementary school, in PE class, occasionally we'd run relay races. So the PE coach would divide us up into our various teams and line us up on one side of the gym, and she'd say go, and so you'd run or skip down to the other side, and then you'd come back, and you got back, and you'd high-five the next person on your team, and they would run and do the same. And she would tell us, once you finish running, just sit down and twiddle your thumbs. Now, I think this is twiddling your thumbs. I'm not 100% positive about that. But even as a little kid, I recognize that there's only so long that you can twiddle your thumbs before you just get bored. And when you get bored, you start causing trouble and you stand up and you start punching people, or at least maybe the little boys did, and you start causing all kinds of ruckus, right? And that happens to all of us. When we stop moving sometimes, we just find ourselves getting into trouble, unruly, being out of step, sacrificing or disrupting the peace within that early church. And so Paul says to warn them, to admonish them, to give them firm counsel about their actions. Now, warning here is done out of love, out of the desire to see the best in someone. And this type of warning doesn't have to be mean. Doesn't have to be mean-spirited. It can be as simple as showing someone the natural consequences of their actions. You're doing this naturally, that is, or potentially that's likely to lead here. As a young dad, it seems not unlike telling your kid not to touch the hot stove because it will burn them. And as a parent, we debate how often do we keep telling them don't touch the stove until one day we just maybe we let them so that they experience the natural consequences of their actions. And so as a mom and dad, we're weighing, is that worth that or should we keep them safe from that? But we show that to them or we tell that to them. It doesn't have to be in a mean way, but we say this is potentially coming from what you're doing. And this way it does feel milder than a rebuke, and often or occasionally the scriptures are instructing us that as Christians, we need to offer something more like a rebuke. But here it's something warm. We can do this as a brother. In fact, in that passage in 2 Thessalonians 3, where Paul speaks about these unruly busybodies, he says this, 3:15. Do not regard him as an enemy, but warn him as a brother. He's one of ours. He's on our team. He wants the same things that we do. Treat him that way. He's not the enemy. You don't have to be mad and upset at him. You can warn him as a brother with love. Thus, it's not a cold rebuke, but a warm warning. To the believers who are in danger of going astray, we offer that gift. Grace is a gift. We offer the gift of a warm warning. A good test for us in our own lives, though, is that sometimes we feel like we need to say something. But sometimes we want to say things to believers who might be unruly because we want to prove something about ourselves. Or we want to say it because we need everyone else in the room to realize we're the smart ones, or that we're in charge, or that they ought to listen to me. And thus what we say becomes about me and not about that brother or sister in Christ who might be unruly. And that might be a good test for us. Am I saying this because of them? Am I saying this really about me and what's happening in my own heart? Paul says, exhort you, brethren. The idea of exhort is to call alongside, to be there, to give you that charge. But it's not a charge that says, hey, you go fix that. It's one that says, I'm going to put my arm around you and we're going to work on this together. And I believe we see that in Jesus' actions and in the way that Jesus relates with those that are following him. In fact, I feel like we see Jesus relate with the same person, Peter, in all of these ways. Now, you know Peter, the leader of the disciples, the one who would often speak first and think second. Some of us can relate to that. Get himself in trouble sometimes, but one who would become a pillar of this early community of those who were following Jesus. In the upper room where Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, the disciples there are bragging about how great they are and what they're going to do. And Peter says, Lord, even if all these other guys fall away from you, I never will. And Jesus says, in fact, Peter, they may fall away, but you're going to do something much worse. You're going to deny even knowing me three times. And in Luke 22, Jesus tells Peter this. Says, Peter, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. But when you have returned to me, strengthen your brothers. Jesus saw the future potential struggles that Peter would have. He saw the direction of Peter, that Peter was headed. And he warns Peter here of the danger. And a great danger it was. Peter, Satan has asked to turn you over, to nearly destroy you. But Jesus let him experience that failure, the failure that was promised. But you see it here, it wasn't the end of it. Peter, Satan is asked to sift you like wheat, but when you have returned to me, when you have experienced that, when you have gone through that and you have come back to me, strengthen your brothers. You're going to go through that and it's going to be difficult when that happens, but now you're going to be in a place where you can offer strength and encouragement to your fellow followers of me. I wonder, when have we struggled with things like this? In your notes, you can see there that each of these four struggles, there are some questions, and they all begin with something like this. When have I? I'm going to give you a moment at the end of the sermon to think through those. When have I struggled with this? Who do I know that's struggling right now with this, and how can I relate to them? But it's important to note that we have to start with our own lives, because any one of us at any time can be this. Hanging on the wall in my office is a picture that my wife Jennifer made for me several years ago. It's a quote that we picked up from Larry Crabb, and it says, "You have further to go than you've already come." You have further to go than you've already come. And we have needed that in our own lives so often. And when we think, we fool ourselves to think we have arrived. It's the reminder that even as far maybe as we have come, there's still further left to go. And so it's important for us as we think about relating to understand that we're all potentially there as well. Who are those believers in our lives that are struggling with being unruly? The Living Bible paraphrases Proverbs 16:27 to say this, "Idle hands are the devil's workshop, idle lips are his mouthpiece." And that's quite the paraphrase of what Proverbs 16:27 says, but there is a little bit of truth there. Because sometimes in life, we just coast. We put things on autopilot and we put it in neutral and we just coast through our families and what's happening in the lives of our families or our spiritual life, and we just sort of let it go. Some of you, or many of you perhaps, have read works of C.S. Lewis, and one of his better known works is the Screwtape Letters. And Screwtape is a very curious book. It's a series of 31 letters written from a seasoned demon named Screwtape, letters to a younger nephew, an inexperienced demon named Wormwood. So it's a backwards book from their perspective. When they say things like the enemy, they mean Jesus. So it's backwards. You got to sort of read it with your head tilted. 31 letters in Screwtape. And at some point in the book, the human, the book calls him the patient, that the younger demon is working with, you want to say it that way, the human becomes a believer, becomes a Christian, places his faith in Jesus. And I like to ask people, when would you expect through the course of those letters that the patient becomes a Christian? And a lot of people would say, like maybe I would, well, maybe right in the middle to provide some balance to the book, or maybe right at the end of the book to give this hurrah, Jesus wins moment at the end of it. But in reality, the patient becomes a Christian after the first letter. And thus the entire book becomes about the spiritual life of the believer from that backwards perspective. And it's so striking to me that in those letters, as C.S. Lewis wrote, he recognized this, that as those demons talk back and forth, they realize that they may have lost the war, but there are still a lot of battles they can win. And they know, and the way they talk, is that if we can just make him ineffective, we're still doing good. If we can just keep him right there where he's at in his spiritual life, we're doing good. If we can just keep him just maybe a little bit off course, we're doing good. All of us have that tendency just to sort of get just a little bit off or just to coast right there. I think about people who have a lot of available time, maybe because they're young or maybe because they're old. They've got available time and it's easy to become idle. And we just let things coast. We sort of expect things to happen. happens for me in my own life, even as a young dad. There are occasionally in our family with three kids, occasionally there are just, I call them magical moments where everything seems to be clicking on all, hitting on all cylinders, and it's just working. There are sometimes in our family dynamic where our kids are sleeping at night, and they're sleeping as long as we want them to in the day, and they wake up when we want them to, and they wake up just happy and cheerful to see us, and we've been able to get up and have some coffee and maybe unload the dishwasher, and just, they're just, kids are polite in the morning, and it's just these just magical times. Now, they don't last long. They maybe go for about a week, and then something happens and disrupts all the harmony there. But in those moments, what I do is I just want to coast. I just want, Lord, just, this is pretty good. Let's just ride it out. And I forget that in those moments where I'm tempted to do that, I lose the perspective of what's the Lord doing in my wife. What's he working in there? How can I be an effective dad in the lives of my kids there? They're obeying me. Isn't that good enough, God? And I forget, what's next? How do I relate with them, right? Like, I want to coast. And there's times in all of our lives where we just want to sort of, can we just take a deep breath and just let it go forever and ever? We need people in our lives who can speak to us in a warm way, who can speak to us the truth, and can wake us up in times like that. This happened for me not too long ago. I was on the phone. So on the phone talking with one of our leaders about a couple in our church. And I thought in the moment I was being wise in giving counsel to this leader in the way I was talking about this couple. And I hung up the phone and Jennifer was there. And Jennifer looked at me and she said, Curtis, if anyone talked about me the way you had just talked about that couple, I would be devastated. Through tears, she said this to me. And she was right. And I needed in that moment to be woken up from my coasting, my look at me just doing this great job, coasting world. And I needed that. And I'm thankful for it. How will you relate to those in your lives that are being unruly? I'm going to give you some time at the end to think about that. The second exhortation that Paul gives, comfort the faint-hearted. Comfort the faint-hearted. The faint-hearted in our lives are those who are discouraged, those who might say this, I am unable to continue. The word picture here is of a small fire that's easily extinguished. If you've ever been camping, you know this, you get that fire going, and just as it's going, all it would take would just be a and it'd blow that little fire out. Or you might have a candle with a small flame, and all it would take is just to open a door in the back and a breeze to blow in, and whoosh, and that fire is gone. That's someone who's faint-hearted, easily extinguished, discouraged, and unable to continue. It's those that have tried hard and failed. It's especially those who are facing grief. Extreme grief over the loss of people, over circumstances. This was the Thessalonian church. As Paul had instructed them about their spiritual lives, and Paul then left there, what had happened was that some of those believers in the church, they had died. They'd started to die. And they had written to Paul, Paul, what do we do? We're facing grief. What's going to happen with them? Which leads Paul in 1 Thessalonians 4 to write about, don't worry. Those who are dead in Christ, well, when the Lord comes back, they'll rise first. And those of us who are alive will meet them in the air. We call that the rapture. And that's going to happen. Paul had to minister to these Thessalonians to comfort them in the middle of their grief. And that's what Paul says. For those who are discouraged, we provide them comfort. We console them. I like this. It's we persuade them not to give up. For those that are grieving, our role is not to fix them. It's not to help them, hey, get over that grief. Get past that. Our role is to persuade them not to give up. They don't need our warning. They don't need our scolding. They need us coming alongside them and sharing in a bit of their experiences. They need us to comfort them. And many times this happens through our presence and not our words. Many times when we speak in those moments, we only speak out of our own insecurity, out of being uncomfortable with maybe the silence or not knowing what to say. How sad it is that often when we, and I myself am here, when we don't know what to say, we say something instead of just staying quiet. Now, it doesn't always happen. Comfort doesn't always happen just through our presence. Sometimes it does happen through our words, and I think we see that in Mark chapter 16. After the resurrection of Jesus, the women have gone to the tomb to find it empty, and they find an angel there. An angel says, I want you to go back and tell the disciples what you've seen and tell Peter what has happened. And they single out, you be sure that you tell Peter. Why? Because Peter has just gone through this tremendous period of loss. He is denied even knowing Jesus. And he is experiencing this loss of everything that he thought he was, this great leader that he thought he was. Jesus, I'll stand up no matter what. And to realize that he is at the bottom of the barrel emotionally. He has experienced that loss. And this angel says, you be sure you go tell Peter what you've seen, this tomb, because this is not the end of his story. And that grief that he's experiencing there in that moment is not the end. We've still got a lot more to do. Doesn't scold Peter, doesn't jeer at him, but speaks into where he is, into that space. You make sure he knows this tomb is empty and we're not done yet. To believers who feel like they can't continue, we offer the gift of genuine care. Who are those among us that are suffering or that are struggling with being faint of heart? Those that are suffering would be here. Those that are experiencing a great loss. It is our privilege many times, you see this, to put people's names in a bulletin so that we can be praying for them as they're experiencing losses. But it's not just the loss of individuals. It's the loss of hopes and dreams. Sometimes something less tangible, and all of us experience those moments in our lives. How will we relate to those believers who are faint-hearted this week? Two Saturdays ago, we had a seminar upstairs that led by a grief counselor and a grief author, Gary Rowe, and he said a lot of really helpful things that morning, told a lot of really unfortunate stories about people not comforting the faint-hearted. But he said this, when we don't know what to say, just say, I'm sorry. Or say, I don't know what to say, except I'm sorry. And you be there. And let your presence be what brings comfort to those who are grieving. The third exhortation that Paul gives is uphold the weak. The weak here, I believe, are those that are spiritually immature. Now, the word can mean weak here, can mean physically weak or sick, and it often does in the Gospels. But in the epistles, it speaks also to those who are weak in their inner life, a weakness of an immaturity. In 1 Corinthians 8, Paul speaks about the weaker brothers among them. And these weaker brothers haven't yet found the maturity to be able to eat any meat they wanted because they're concerned that this meat might have been dedicated to idols. And they haven't realized yet or haven't grown in their knowledge, their maturity, that those things don't exist. It's fine. God has made those things clean. We can eat them. And he calls them the weaker brothers. Now, this is not, though, a negative term. And it doesn't give us reason to feel proud about where we are. But for those who are weak, Paul says, he exhorts us to uphold them, to be devoted to them, to help them right where they're at. When we encounter those who are weak, it is easy for us to look down our noses at them, to make ourselves feel important, to say, well, look at me, how great I am, that I'm not like that person. But the exhortation here from Paul is that we should not give up on them. Don't give up on them, even though they might be struggling with this immaturity. Don't just give them empty promises that you're there for them. You be there for them, and you don't give up. I remember when I was a freshman in college, I was a part of a little Bible study, and the leader of that Bible study pulled me aside one time, and he said, Curtis, I've enjoyed having you here in the study. I think what you need in your spiritual life is some personal one-on-one discipleship, and I'd love to take time to meet with you once a week and to talk about your relationship with the Lord and to encourage you to grow in that. And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I think I'm good right now. And I went off to summer camp, working at camp that summer, and of the many things the Lord taught me was just how immature I was and how further to go I really had. And so when I got back to school my sophomore year, I called up my friend and I said, hey, remember last year when you talked with me about wanting to meet and disciple me one-on-one and I told you no? Can we do that? Because I need that. And he said, yeah, I'd love to do that. And I think back to that moment, and I can picture myself, if I'm on the other end of that conversation, saying, what? I just made all this time, made myself available to you, and now you just rejected me in this way? Man, you need this. Don't you know you need this? I'm done. Forget it. Delete you from my phone or whatever it would be. I think it would have been really easy for him to do that. But he didn't. Because we're called to uphold the weak, to be devoted to them right where they are. To believers who are spiritually immature, we offer the gift of committed devotion. In Acts chapter 10, it's a great story. Peter's up on a roof and it's lunchtime and he's hungry. And while he's hungry, he has a vision about food. I can relate to that. And in the vision, he sees a sheet come down from the heavens, and there's all sorts of animals on the sheet, animals that under the Mosaic law were considered unclean. And Peter hears the voice of Jesus say, rise, kill, and eat. And Peter says, no, Lord, I wouldn't do that. Those animals are unclean. And Jesus says, do not call unclean what I have called clean. And three times they have this interchange back and forth, three times. And the sheet goes up. Finally, in the vision, and the vision is over. Here, I think we have an example of Jesus relating to Peter in his immaturity. You see, Peter would have been with Jesus back in Mark chapter 7 as Jesus engages with some Pharisees. And Jesus says this, it's not what comes into the body that defiles a person, but what comes out of them that defiles a person. And in that story of Mark chapter 7, Mark tells us that with that statement, Jesus is making all food clean. And Peter has had the chance over those years of ministering with Jesus to pick up that lesson. And now here we are years later. You know what Peter is? He's immature in this area. And he needs Jesus to be patient and to uphold him, to be devoted to him right there where he's at and minister to him in that way. And he does. And the door is opened now for the good news of Jesus to go out to the Gentiles, and the church begins to spread among those not just who are of Jewish descent. Who are those among us that are struggling with experiencing weakness? Think certainly about new believers, people who have recently found the Lord. I think about those who might have come from a denominational background or a family that would have valued some things over others, and now there needs to be a certain level of freedom in their life that the scriptures would give. I think about those whose actions are not consistent with their words. Those that would say they want one thing, but their very actions would demonstrate something different, or their very actions would be the thing that would be inhibiting them from reaching what they say they want. And you know those people in your lives that are inconsistent in that way. The difficulty here is that those that are immature often believe they are, in fact, mature. That was me. In my immaturity, I thought I was more mature than I am. How will you be devoted to that person? How will you relate to them this week? Back in 1 Corinthians 8, as Paul speaks about the weaker brother, Paul says, I would I would gladly never eat meat again if it meant I got to minister to that person. I'd give it all up. I'd give up my freedoms so that I could minister to them. Finally, if you've ever ministered to or been around those who are unruly or faint-hearted or weak, you know that they rarely follow scripts. They rarely follow our prescribed plan. Change rarely happens as we want it to. I change rarely on my own schedule. But the grace of God allows us to relate to all of these people here in the fourth exhortation from Paul with patience, that we would be patient with them all. All being the three people that we've already discussed, as well as everyone else in the church. We are patient with them. We stay with them in the midst of wherever they are. There's two words for patient in the New Testament. One of them speaks about endurance through trials, being patient in the midst of trials. The other one is here, and it's a relational term of being dedicated and devoted to that very person who might be at times hard to deal with. To do this well, our hearts must be mature. We must know that what is happening is not about me, and we must put that aside. And the most important thing is that we have to have a vision for that person, a vision of what they can be because of Christ who is in them and the new creation that God has made them to be, a vision for how God sees them. Not just what we see on the outside, not just because of the mistakes or the failures that we may see them make, a vision for the better, deeper, eternal part of them. Theodore Roosevelt said this, "It is not so important as what a man is as what he is becoming, because he will be what he is becoming." That's sort of a wordy quote. But the idea is, I am less concerned with what I can see in front of me as the person that you are becoming, because at the end of it all, that's who you're going to be. And as a believer in Jesus, I want you to be pursuing Christ because Christ lives in you. And thus, my responsibility is to have that vision for your life and call that out of you, regardless of just what's happening on the outside. And that comes through being patient, being devoted. To believers who are not where we want them to be, we offer the gift of an enduring spirit. In John 21, we see Jesus relate to Peter this way. As they sit there at that shore having their breakfast, and Jesus asks him, "Peter, do you love me more than these?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Peter, do you love me more than these? "Yes, Lord." "Peter, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord." And you just get almost the feeling of, Jesus, what more do you want from me here? And following that grief and loss in Peter's life, now Jesus begins to restore him with patience and to tell him, "Peter, I'm going to be right there where you are. And whatever you have to give right here in this moment, it's good enough. I'm there with you. I'm devoted to you. I'm not going to give up on you." Let's move forward together. Who are those among us that are struggling, or that we're struggling to provide the extra patience? Maybe there's a family member who's veering off from the Lord and you've tried to give instruction many times. Maybe a friend who continues making a series of wrong choices. Maybe it's someone in your life with whom you're just tired of giving second chances. Be patient with all. How will you relate to them this week? We began this series on the grace of God with an image of waves on a seashore, and wave after wave after wave coming into the seashore, and God's grace being like that, grace upon grace upon grace. And that's how he relates to us. And as believers, we have the opportunity to now to extend that metaphor and to be agents of grace for others, and that the grace that we would extend to them would be grace upon grace upon grace. I'd like to close this morning just with giving you a few moments to think through those questions. How have you struggled with these things in 1 Thessalonians? Who is struggling right now with those things, and how will you relate to them? And as we give you some time to think and to pray, maybe make a few notes, you might just close your eyes, because we're going to play that Waze video again as that reminder. How will you be that agent of grace upon grace upon grace with the fellow believers in your life this week. I'll give you a few moments for that, and I'll close this again in prayer. Father, we recognize that any one of us at any time, that I can be just like these, the weak or the one that needs patience or the faint-hearted or the unruly, and that you've dealt with me in a gracious way in those moments. And that there are people in our lives that we can extend that grace to in various ways. We can relate to them appropriately to encourage them in their walk with you. And so I pray that this week we would have the opportunity to do that, to begin living out the instructions here from 1 Thessalonians 5, that we live it out in a way that honors you, in a way that invites these fellow believers in our life to push to become more like your Son, Jesus. We pray in his name. Amen.